There was a danger that it would simply sink the boat under them. It took an hour of agonizing work on deck before they felt the Caird begin to regain her buoyancy, but they kept at it until they had succeeded in getting rid of most of the ice except a large chunk on the sea anchor line, which they simply could not risk attempting to reach. Shackleton then called them below to have some milk. They gathered around the stove, almost sick with cold. It seemed inconceivable that their numbed bodies could have given off any warmth, but apparently they did, for after a while the icicles under the decking began to melt and drip down onto them. Not long afterward, the water in the bottom had thawed enough so they could pump it out. Shackleton still had Cream keep the primus stove alight, but toward noon the acrid fumes it gave off had made the air almost unbreathable, and it had to be extinguished. It took several minutes for the atmosphere to clear, and then they became aware of a new smell, a fetid, sweet-sour sort of odor, like spoiled meat. McNeish discovered it came from the sleeping bags, which in fact had begun to rot. A closer examination disclosed that two of them actually were slimy inside. Throughout the afternoon, the coating of ice steadily built up again, and late in the day, Shackleton decided there was too much at stake to gamble on the chance that the Caird would survive until morning. Once more, he ordered that the boat be cleared. It took more than an hour, but finally it was done, and after a ration of hot milk, they settled down to wait for morning. The southwesterly gales screamed on, showing not the slightest sign of fatigue. The watches of that night were like a tally sheet of infinity. Every individual minute had to be noted, then lived through and finally checked off. There was not even a crisis to relieve the tortured monotony. When at last, about 6 o'clock, the sky to the east began to brighten, they could see that once again the boat was carrying a dangerously heavy burden of ice. As soon as light permitted, she had to be chipped clear for the third time. It was May the 2nd, and the beginning of the third day of the gale. The weather throughout had been overcast so that no position could be obtained. Now the anxiety of not really knowing where they were was added to everything else. Sometime after 9 o'clock, the wind eased ever so slightly, though nowhere near enough to get under way. A few minutes later, the Caird rose to a particularly high sea, and just then she was struck by a breaking wave. The smallest quiver, a gentle shock, passed through her, and the wave rolled on. But this time, she didn't swing back up into the wind. The sea anchor was gone. Chapter 4. There was a moment of confusion. Then they felt her roll sickeningly to starboard as she fell off into the trough of the sea, and they knew instinctively what had happened. Both Shackleton and Worsley scrambled to their feet and looked forward. The frayed end of the bowline was dragging through the water. The lump of ice was gone, and the sea anchor with it. Shackleton thrust his head below and shouted for the others to get the jib. They hauled it out, frozen into a rumpled mass. Crean and McCarthy crept forward over the heavily rolling deck, dragging the sail with them. The rigging, too, was frozen and had to be beaten into compliance. But after a long minute or two, they got enough ice off the halyards to hoist the jib to the mainmast as a storm trysail. Slowly, grudgingly, the Caird's bow once more swung around into the wind, and all of them felt the tension go out of their muscles. The job of the helmsman now was to hold her as close to the wind as she would go, swinging from one tack to the other. It required constant vigilance, and it could hardly have been more unpleasant facing into the breaking seas and the piercing wind. Fortunately, the gale continued to diminish, and by 11 o'clock, Shackleton decided to risk hoisting sail. The jib was removed from the mainmast, and the reefed lug sail and mizzen were run up. Then, for the first time in 44 hours, the Caird was under way again toward the northeast, and the journey was resumed. But it was a slovenly course, with the boat running before the enormous following sea, her bow half buried by the force of the wind astern. Shortly after noon, as if from nowhere, a magnificent, wandering albatross appeared overhead. In contrast to the caird, it soared with an ease and grace that was poetic, riding the gale on wings that never moved, sometimes dropping to within 10 feet of the boat, then rising almost vertically on the wind, 100, 200 feet, only to plunge downward again in a beautifully effortless sweep. It was perhaps one of nature's ironies. Here was her largest, most incomparable creature, capable of flight, whose wingspread exceeded 11 feet from tip to tip, and to whom the most violent storm was meaningless, sent to accompany the caird, as if in mockery of her painful struggles. Hour after hour the albatross circled overhead, and there was an elegance of motion to the bird's flight that was very nearly hypnotic. The men could hardly avoid a feeling of envy. Worsley remarked that the albatross could probably have covered the distance to South Georgia in 15 hours or less. As if to emphasize their wretchedness, Worsley recorded, "Reindeer bags in such a hopeless, sloppy, slimy mess, smelling badly and weighing so heavily that we throw two of the worst overboard. Each of them weighed about 40 pounds. Later he wrote, "Magdy, McCarthy, is the most irrepressible optimist I've ever met. When I relieve him at the helm, boat iced and seas pouring down your neck, he informs me with a happy grin, "It's a grand day, sir." I was feeling a bit sour just before. Throughout the afternoon and evening, the weather gradually grew less violent, and by dawn on May the 3rd, the wind had fallen off to a moderate southwesterly breeze. As noon approached, the clouds started to thin out. Before long, patches of blue sky appeared, and soon the sun was shining down. Worsley took out his sextant, and it was no task at all to get a sight. When he had worked it out, the Fix put their position at 56 degrees 13 minutes south, 45 degrees 38 minutes west, 403 miles from Elephant Island. They were just more than halfway to South Georgia. Thus, in the space of only an hour, or maybe a little more, the outlook on board the caird was completely altered. The battle was half won, and a warm sun was overhead. The off-duty watch no longer huddled in the dismal confines of the forecastle. Instead, the sleeping bags were hauled out and run up the mast to dry. The men peeled off various articles of clothing, and boots, socks, and sweaters were tied onto the shrouds and backstay. The sight that the caird presented was one of the most incongruous imaginable. Here was a patched and battered 22-foot boat, daring to sail alone across the world's most tempestuous sea, her rigging festooned with a threadbare collection of clothing and half-rotten sleeping bags. Her crew consisted of 6 men, whose faces were black with caked soot and half-hidden by matted beards, whose bodies were dead white from constant soaking in salt water. In addition, their faces, and particularly their fingers, were marked with ugly round patches of missing skin, where frostbites had eaten into their flesh. Their legs, from the knees down, were chafed and raw from the countless punishing trips crawling across the rocks in the bottom, and all of them were afflicted with salt water boils on their wrists, ankles, and buttocks. But had someone unexpectedly come upon this bizarre scene, undoubtedly the most striking thing would have been the attitude of the men. Relaxed, even faintly jovial, almost as if they were on an outing of some sort. Worsley took out his log and wrote, "Moderate sea, southerly swell, blue sky, passing clouds, fine, clear weather, able to reduce some parts of our clothing from wet to damp, to Leith Harbour, 347 miles. By evening, the sun had done a wonderful job of drying, and when they crawled into their sleeping bags that night, the sensation was distinctly pleasant, at least by comparison. The good weather held throughout the night and into the following day, May the 4th, and again the gear was distributed among the rigging. The wind was out of the southeast at no more than 15 knots. Only an occasional sea splashed on board, so that they had to pump only twice during the day. Worsley's sight at noon put the position at 55 degrees 31 minutes south, 44 degrees 43 minutes west, a run of 52 miles in 24 hours. 2 days of good weather had worked their magic, and among the entire crew there was a growing feeling of confidence, subtle but unmistakable. In the beginning, South Georgia had existed only as a name, infinitely distant and lacking in reality. But no more. They were, even at this moment, less than 250 miles from the nearest point on South Georgia, and having already covered 450 miles, the distance that remained was at least conceivable. 3 days more, or maybe four at the most, should see them there. And then it would all be over. And so that peculiar brand of anxiety, born of an impossible goal that somehow comes within reach, began to infect them. Nothing overt, really, just a sort of added awareness, a little more caution and more care to ensure that nothing preventable should go wrong now. The wind remained steady out of the southeast during the night, though it grew considerably stronger, with occasional squalls to almost 40 knots. With the coming of light on May the 5th, the weather had returned to its old familiar pattern. Overcast sky with a nasty, lumpy sea running. The wind was on the starboard beam, so that the spray broke over almost at will. By 9 o'clock, everything was as wet as it had ever been. Otherwise, it was a notably uneventful day, distinguished only by the fact that toward evening, the wind shifted slowly to the north and then the northwest. It increased in velocity, too, and by dark was blowing a gale. Steering was difficult that night. The sky was overcast, and the pennant on the mainmast by which the course had once been kept had blown away bit by bit in successive gales. Now they had to steer by the feel of the boat, and by watching the shadowy white line of a breaking sea ahead. At midnight, after a drink of hot milk, Shackleton's watch took over, and Shackleton himself assumed the helm, while Crean and McNeish stayed below to pump. His eyes were just growing accustomed to the dark when he turned and saw a rift of brightness in the sky astern. He called to the others to tell them the good news that the weather was clearing to the southwest. A moment later, he heard a hiss, accompanied by a low, muddled roar, and he turned to look again. The rift in the clouds, actually the crest of an enormous wave, was advancing rapidly toward them. He spun around and instinctively pulled his head down. "For God's sake, hold on!" he shouted. "It's got us!" For a long instant, nothing happened. The Caird simply rose higher and higher, and the dull thunder of this enormous breaking wave filled the air. And then it hit, and she was caught in a mountain of seething water and catapulted bodily forward and sideways at the same time. She seemed actually to be thrown into the air, and Shackleton was nearly torn from his seat by the deluge of water that swept over him. The lines to the rudder went slack, then suddenly seized up again as the boat was viciously swung around like some contemptible plaything. For an instant, nothing existed but water. They couldn't even tell whether she was upright. But then the instant was over. The wave had rolled on. And the Caird, though stunned and half-dead under a load of water that rose nearly to the seats, was miraculously still afloat. Crean and McNeish seized the first implements that came to hand and began to bail furiously. A moment later, Worsley's watch fought their way out of the sleeping bags and joined the struggle, throwing water over the side with a wild urgency, knowing that the next wave would surely be the finish unless they could lighten her before it struck. Shackleton at the helm kept looking astern for another telltale streak of brightness. But none appeared. And ever so slowly, as they frantically pumped and bailed and ladled the water overboard, the Caird lifted to the seas again. The ballast had shifted, and the glass on the compass was broken, but they apparently had won. It took more than 2 hours to get her emptied out, and much of the time they were working in icy water to their knees. Crean started a search for the primus stove. He found it at last, wedged up against the ribs of the boat, but it was completely clogged. For a half hour he worked over it in the dark, his patience slowly ebbing away. Finally,